take for Heritage Development. Today is November 4th, 1980, and we are at St. Mary's Convent in Freeport, PA.
I'm Sister Melania Polanski.
I'm Sister Sally Witt, interviewing, and Sister Bernadette Carlo is also present with us. Melania, I really wanted to ask you to retell some of the things you told me before when I talked to you with Bailey. Maybe I don't even have to be specific.
Okay. Around my heritage and living in the mining towns and my grandparents' experience and coming from the Ukraine.
Right.
Okay. I guess that is so, you know, rich in my mind, and those experiences were so real, although I didn't personally live them as much as my mother, you know, and father did. But I remember some of the stories as they were told to me when I was a child. And I remember the how my grandfather worked for the formation of the unions. They were, you know, establishing the United Mine Workers Union, and some of the attempts that were made, like to curtail that activity. How oftentimes on a picket line, they would the women and children would be, you know, at the entrance of the mine. And the company police, I think they called them the Yellow Dogs, would come in on their horses. I don't know if they wore yellow coats or yellow boots or something like that, where they got that name. And they would just crash right into the picket line, you know, and not regard the children or the women at all. They could have been really badly hurt. So,
where was this?
In little mining towns in this area, like around Use and in the Canonsburg area, they moved from mining patch to mining patch wherever there was like work. So I don't know specifically where some of these incidents were. I just know that it would be here in the western part of Pennsylvania, you know, around the greater Pittsburgh area. I remember also them telling about how in the mining towns the men would work one shift or two shifts, and there would be, you know, production to be, you know, filled, and the company men would come to the houses of the people and ask the men to work a third shift, and they just couldn't, physically they couldn't do it anymore. And my grandmother used to lie, you know, and say my grandfather wasn't home. And of course, they'd say, well, where is he? Because there was no place to go. You were stuck there. You know, there wasn't any transportation or anything. So those were kind of really vivid things in my mind about his work. And I know at one point, although I don't know the specifics around it, he was jailed for his union activity. He was actually, you know, put in jail. And in order to meet the family needs, like, around, you know, providing for the family, my grandmother would do washing and ironing for the neighbors. She was very clever. She could sew. She would sew for them. She did a lot of bootlegging. She did. They had a steal, I think, all the time. She kept boarders. Worked really, really hard. Their family was so important to them. Oftentimes in that struggle, the family suffered because of those activities. But, you know, their sense of providing for their family was really, really very, very strong. And she would, you know, she supplemented what he was often doing. And I remember especially them talking about when he had to go to jail for those activities.
How did they feel about his being?
I don't know that I remember, as a child, picking up, you know, that feel. I know, like in our culture, it wasn't very nice to be in jail. I don't think that they felt that he had done anything wrong. He was really trying to work for a just, you know, working condition, and that was a part of it. Although I don't know that they held their head high over it or had a sense. I'll say, like I would have now for a social justice issue, if I were jailed, I would not consider that being something to be ashamed of. I don't know exactly how they felt around that. I'm sure, you know, people who were not in that situation probably held them in contempt.
What about, did you grow up in 84 PA?
I grew up in, our address was 84 RD2, but it was actually a mining patch that we lived in. It was owned by the Ontario Hillman Mining Company,
coal company. Hillman.
I'm not exactly sure. It's a Hillman Coal Company, I think, is what it was. And they called the little town Ontario. And, we always said we were from Ontario, although our local address was 84 RD2, but we didn't use it because we had no mail service in the town. And so we had to go back to another mining town, which was called Cokeburg, which was about a mile up the hill. We were settled down in a little valley. You come down into it, like very much like Freeport here. You come down a great big hill, and there's this little mining patch settled at the bottom. And there was a post office in Cokeburg, and that's where we got most of our mail. Otherwise, it was dropped off at a local grocery store, and everybody's mail was thrown in one big box, and you'd have to come in and shuffle. So my mother didn't like everybody knowing our business or handling it. So we maintained a box up in Cokeburg. Later on, she went on and got a petition for the town to have the mail carried across the railroad tracks. And each home now has a box, and a letter carrier comes across the tracks and delivers. So now we use the address 84 RD2.
When was it that you paid for it to get the delivery?
Oh, I'd say probably about 10 years ago. Up to about 10 years ago or so. And it was that a petition had to be signed. She took it upon herself to get the petition and go from house to house and have people sign so that they would have that, you know, service.
You told me before about another delivery she organized, too.
I don't recall that one.
Wasn't it milk delivery?
No. The mail. Okay. It was the mail delivery, yes.
What are the differences now? Does your family still live in the house?
My mother, yes. My mother lives there. My brother, who's unmarried, lives there with her.
What are some of the things that are different there?
Well, probably not too much more. It's become just a little town for rural living. Like, there is nothing there in the town. The mine was sealed in 56 or 57. And people went elsewhere or just stayed on and got jobs other places and then commuted. But in fact, there's less there now than there was, you know, when I was growing up. The only business is one local beauty shop, which is maintained in a home, and a beer garden. I guess that's all. There isn't even a grocery store there now.
Who owned that grocery store?
Well, there was a company store owned by the mining company. There was also an independent grocery store there also. And the people, you know, either chose one of the two. And I guess a lot of people went to the company store because it was checked off out of your pay. And so you never had... You know, some people really never received much of a pay. And the company store had other things in it, you know, like household things and clothes. And so oftentimes, whatever the family needed, they just got from the company store. The bill was tallied and checked off before the miners ever reached, you know, received the pay or received just the little bit that was left.
You had said one time about your feelings around your father working in the mine when you were growing up.
Yes, I think that he often talked about, nobody was better than you, and never forget that. And I guess, but the work was so hard and so encompassing, and I think being first-generation immigrants, from immigration family, I think he really felt keenly that he probably wasn't as good as everybody else. But I think what he wanted to pass on to his family was that that's not the way to feel, I always understood what he was saying, but I felt or intuitively picked up that he himself did not have that great sense about himself, that given other conditions and other circumstances, he probably would have, been able to do much more. But I think his own father came as an immigrant to this country and worked in the mines. And he himself went into the mines when he was 14, never had more than a sixth grade education.
This was your father?
This is my father.
Where did his father come from?
His father came from Poland. And, the Ukraine. His mother was from Poland. And his father was from the Ukraine. Often what happened would be people would come from the old country, and they had been neighbors there or neighbors' children, and then they met in the same little mining towns over here. They would be, maybe they know a relative, and then that relative would know another relative. Like, my mom's family and my dad's family had known each other in the old country. And so they had the support of each other, and that often happened. In those towns, you found families, that had come over.
Did there seem to be any segregation according to the national origin of people?
In our town, there were like two groups of people, as I would recall them. It would be the ethnic people, those who were like from the Slavonic countries, like Poland and the Ukraine and That's real good. Like from Eastern Europe. And then there were also in the mining patch people that would be like from the Appalachia area, those whose origins were not directly this generation from the old countries, whose names were like different than ours. You know, we had the skis on the end and the ICs on the end. Those people, in comparison to the Joneses and the Smiths. So there really were like two different styles of living, very, very much. And I think each group were kind of prejudiced in their living. Speaking from my group, it was the old work ethic. You work and you keep your house clean, and the harder you work, the better you are, economy, like saving your money and being very resourceful. And then the rich heritage of the customs, those who were very, very rich around all the holidays and the foods. I went to it was like a one-room schoolhouse, although there were really like three rooms in it. And so we were thrown together, with the other children. And it was interesting. So many of my friends did not have those rich cultures that, say, we did, who were from, like, Polish or Ukrainian background, who had, like, kind of a real rich heritage around our music. Or else we were just more aware of it. I don't know.
What are some examples?
Those customs. At Christmas time, we always had a Christmas Eve dinner and laid straw. Now, my grandmother kept them more closely than my mother did, but we did, and we still do. But she would lay the straw on the table, and put the, you know, like cloth over top of that, because that was like a symbolic of the straw in the manger. And there were 13 foods on the table. Certain kinds of food, like there had to be fish, there were halloumis and mushrooms and, 13 specific kinds of food that they would have in honor of the Christmas Eve when Christ was born. There was always the blessing of the homes in the Christmas season, like at the as you moved after Christmas into the beginning of the year, the priest would come with a choir in some places. Now in our town, the priest would only come with maybe like a cantor and burn incense and bless each room in the house. We had coal stoves, so he would, you know, burn the incense right on top of the stove, and you could smell it throughout the whole house. Remember that, and then he would mark the door. Easter was really rich. And,
how did he mark the door?
He marked it with a sign, a cross, and then the year 19, and then symbols of that this house was blessed with a piece of chalk, and we kept it up all year. In fact, like only like at the end of the year, my mother would wash it off in preparation for the new blessing, which would be next year. So, and I'm not sure right now if they do, but I know all the while I was growing up, the parish priest came every year to bless the homes of the parishioners. And at Christmas time, at Easter time, we had a custom like in the blessing of the food baskets of everything that you would have for your Easter morning breakfast. The Easter bread, the traditional Easter bread, which was decorated with just the beautiful signs of Easter, whatever the family liked. They would plait designs on the top and bake the bread. And there would be crosses on them. And one of the breads, which was called the Easter Pascha, would have an egg in it. And you would bake it, a raw egg, in the shell, right in the center of the bread. Then that was the bread that you would have for your morning breakfast. And at the breakfast table, all the food that you had blessed in the basket would be used, even like the coffee and the salt and the butter were often molded in the shape of a lamb, signify the lamb had been slain. And just a lot of really beautiful artistic kinds of things. And then whenever we would first sit down, the head of the house, whoever that would be, would take the Easter egg that had been baked in the Easter Pascha and crack it open, and would cut as many pieces of that egg as there were people at the table, and then to signify the wholeness now in Christ, and would begin with a person to the side of them and say, in Ukrainian, Christos is Christ, which is Christ has arisen, and the person would answer, yes, and was Christ, which means, yes, he has arisen, and then would take a piece of that egg, and he would take the egg and present it to each person at the table, saying to them, Christ has arisen, and they would answer back, yes, he has arisen, and then that would be like the, you know, ritual in remembrance of the resurrection. There was always the decorating in the traditional Ukrainian designs. My grandfather always made her a stylus, and they would take the wire that was made and dipped in wax, and she would make these dye-resist eggs with intricate symbolic designs on the eggs, and they would give that to their friends in remembrance. That was another beautiful custom. And then through the years, my grandmother became very, very adept, and so did my mother. And I have a collection of the Ukrainian pisanka. And they're really just beautiful.
What's that?
It's the Easter egg. It's the egg designs with all kinds of just beautiful, beautiful symbolic gestures on them.
That custom of Christmas with 13 foods, it seems to me you were poor people.
Yes.
How did you get 13 foods on your table? Was that ever hard or unusual?
No, I think it was things that people always had. Like you get the mushrooms in the field. My uncles always went out and picked mushrooms. My grandfather and grandmother knew how to pick, you know, mushrooms. The foods were like cheeses. They often made their own cheeses. My grandmother didn't, and my mom didn't, that I can remember. Your bread, you know, so it was things that they had. We had peas. I don't know if that was in the, you know, traditional, but oftentimes they were canned in jars, you know. So there was always fish on the table because it was the time when you had to fast, when, you know, like with that custom, you know, and the halupkis, which are usually made, the cabbage rolls with ground meat and rice, at that time were made with buckwheat groats, which is a grain, instead of ground meat, because they did not eat, you know, meat before. They continued the fast up till the, you know, Christmas Day. So they counted like everything on the table, like your relish and sardines. We always had sardines. I don't know where that came from, but that was always a part of the custom.
I'd like to get back to some of the things about your experience of when your father was going to work when you were a child.
Yes. I think with the mine being right there, in the town, everybody's life really revolved around that mine, and the men worked different shifts, so they went in at different times. And it was very, very dangerous, especially in the early years before they had safety rules. Like oftentimes the mines were supported by timbers, which could easily just crush. And oftentimes men were crushed by falling timbers in the mine. And a lot of the heavy work was done with animals like mules and workhorses. And oftentimes if they did not cooperate, the animals, they often, you know, hurt the men themselves or ran into different things. So it really was a very dangerous place to work. And I know, I remember as a child often kissing my father goodbye and thinking this may be the last time. That was something really, really real. And if I maybe happened to be in just a very tender mood, I would, you know, even cry, realizing that perhaps that was the last time that I would see him. And when the mine whistle would blow, when it wasn't a change of shifts, my mother would often be a signal that there had been an accident in the mine. And I often remember my mother saying, "Thank God Daddy's home with us," or "Thank God Daddy's sleeping." But if he wasn't, all the women would run. They would just leave the wash, the kid, you know, grab the children that had to be taken care of, and run across the field over to the mine to see who they were carrying out on the stretcher. So that was like a real part of the life, that, you know, that living in that constant fear.
Did you ever experience any spread sickness?
No, I never had that experience of like anybody being tragically hurt. Now my dad had a lot of experiences by picking up the pieces of the man he was working with, especially when the machinery came in. And if they got too close to it, I'm not exactly what happened, but like the machine could cut them up. And I remember him talking about he picked up somebody's arms and he just collected the man in pieces. So he often had that experience, but I never experienced, like, say, any of our friends or my uncles or anybody being hurt in the mine.
Did your father belong to the union?
Yes, he belonged to the union. And I know John L. Lewis was a great, great man in the eyes of all the people. We used to get the United Mine Workers Journal. And I'm not sure what I remember from it, but I loved to read. I learned to read when I was very little. And I read anything, whether I understood it or not. And we had the, you know, outside outhouses, and often would take the United Mine Workers journal up there, you know, and read it in the outhouse. But that was the great newsletter, you know, that came to the people. And I remember my aunts and uncles and my grandparents and my mom and dad talking about what a great man John L. Lewis was for bringing, you know, fair working conditions to the people and really working through. And I remember we lived through a lot of strikes in my, you know, lifetime, in my growing up. And my family never minded. They would try to save a little bit because they knew a strike would come, that it would be inevitable. And so they would say, my mother would say, no, we have to save for this because, you know, we're going to be on strike in maybe 2 months or 3 months, and we never know how long it's going to last. And so there was always the garden. There was always the canning of the food, you know, and the sharing of, like, you know, resources. Like, I bought a lot of clothes for my cousins, and we did a lot of that kind of sharing, so that there were those things that we, you know, needed, and there was always a mind and a provision for that.
What about the fact that different ethnic groups lived in different home houses? Do you think that the mine owners had anything to do with that? Well, I'm uh-huh. trying to think about encouraging. Did they try to encourage the divisions?
No, I never felt a sense, you know, of that. I really wouldn't be able to answer that question. I think each group there thought their group was the best, you know, but I think that was like a natural. To my knowledge, you know, or through my experience, I'm not aware of that.
What about yourself then? How did you get to know the Sisters of St. Joseph?
Well, that's really a funny story, I guess. I had gone to college on a lay teacher plan, which was your parish paid a half of your tuition, and the college that received you paid the other half. And then, like, you had to provide for your own books and transportation, all those other kinds of things. The half tuition given by the college was their gift to Catholic education. And the half provided by your parish, you had to work in your parish for a year or two, depending upon what kind of an agreement you made with your pastor, to pay that back. So, like, your salary then what became your paying back instead of, you know, receiving a salary, and you received just a small stipend. Well, I went to Duquesne for 2 years, for over 2 years, on that plan, and my college roommate had been a postulant in the Sisters of St. Joseph, and she had stayed about 6 months, I think, and she loved the sisters. She had had them all through school and so forth. And then I went to teach in my, we don't really have a parish where we are. We were a sister parish to St. Clement's in Ellsworth. We just had Mass in Cokeburg up at St. Joseph's on Sunday. And so I went down to St. Clement's to teach. I was the first lay teacher that they had ever had in the school, which was quite a unique experience. And well, I guess I just fell in love with children and God and everything at that time, and felt I had a call and wanted to enter some community. Well, the sisters were, the school was staffed by the Sisters of St. Francis from Monticissi in Bellevue, so I was kind of thinking in terms of that. Of course, they really wanted me, you know, to come and be with them, but my pastor, I guess, knew me more than they did, and he said, I would suggest, Shirley, that you look around and maybe choose a congregation that is more American, because they were really very old country-ish, you know. And I had gone, at Duquesne, I had met a sister, the Poor Child Jesus from Columbus, Ohio, and I just liked her personally very much. So I went out to visit her, and then, of course, I told Betty, my roommate, that I you know, been at school with about my plans, and she says, "Sure, I have the best place in the world for you." She says, "You come down to my house and I'll take you over to Mount Gallitzin." So that's where I went, and finally I made the decision to go to Mount Gallitzin, you know, to go to Sisters of St. Joseph.
As you look back now, do you think that there's anything in our charism that you were growing up that would make you choose us?
I guess that's really hard, you know. Perhaps it was... I'm not exactly sure how I made that decision, you know, to be a sister of St. Joseph, when, you know, when it came to the final decision. I think I was thinking in terms of my parents. I really felt a great attraction to all three, but then when I thought about it, one was more of an attraction to a person. And then... I really respect his judgment of my pastor around the Sisters of St. Francis. I really, and so I really can't say I made the decision like for any kind of an attraction from a community, because I knew so little about any community. But my father was very uncomfortable with the Sisters of the Poor Child Jesus. They were out sighing their grass. It was real high, and they were doing a lot of really grassroots things like that. He just was so uncomfortable with that.
What were they doing to the grass?
Cutting it with a scythe.
Oh.
And they just didn't seem to be stable or something. And I felt his uncomfortableness about that, although he would never have told me where to go. And I could understand that aspect about the Sisters of St. Francis. I had just been with them a year. It was like that really wasn't like who I was. And so the third person was almost by default, you know, the third choice. But I really felt that I wanted to enter. And since I hardly knew anything about anything along lines of religious congregations, I made that choice.
Are there any connections that you make now with your actions and your choices? I'd like to say that are specifically having to do with living in a coal patch, eating family.
I think, I guess I'm just always so aware of people's struggles, especially around self-concept and self-image and a sense of worth. I probably know on a very gut level of how people can really be persecuted, not only in a physical way, but also in a psychological way. And I think that I tend to always, identify with that often in my choices, in my decisions. And I think the struggle is always, how do I best serve that? I know I don't think that at this stage in my development that we can always go, or that I can go back and be there at that stage. But how do I serve from where I am now? And I think that's always the painful question. At the same time, always being so aware of that struggle, say with like members in my family.
I don't have specific questions for you here. Do you have other comments you'd like to make that could?
I guess maybe like the one comment I would make would be like around the whole area of thankfulness and gratefulness and gratitude. I think probably the thing that I could am so aware of, like with my parents, I think the greatest thing they gave me was a sense of honesty and a sense of caring and a sense of gratitude. They, even when things were hard and bad, they were always thanking God and meaning it. And I think my grandparents too, in the midst of all those struggles, and they had all kinds of struggles their whole life. I'll never forget, my grandfather went through a series of little strokes, you know, it gradually just weakened him. And to a point where he couldn't even feed himself. And I was down visiting them one time, and my grandmother was feeding him. And before she put the spoon to his mouth, as well as he could, he took his hand, he took her hand, and he was kissing it. And he said, "Marenya, Marenya, your hands are my life." I think they always had that sense of gratitude in the midst of all their trials. They still thank God, and they found something to be thankful for. I just think that, you know, that sense of life that is worth living, especially for my grandparents, that sense, you know. And then just the honesty and integrity for my own parents, that I think that to them that was the most important thing. And I really am grateful for that. And also I think to have been touched, my own life, to know the realities of struggle, I think that is a real blessing. And even though it's painful, you know, like when I in some way try to answer the calls of, say, the migrant workers, or even if I can't physically do it, to know it in a way that perhaps other people don't know it, I think that is a real blessing and a real grace, to know that. I don't always know what to do with it, but I find that that is a real grace.
Thank you.
You're welcome.